Okay, good. So today is July 3rd, right, 2013. I'm Rick Hansen. And this talk and discussion really is related to what we got into last week. You may remember I was telling a story about myself last week, messing up with my wife and being impatient and violating, as it were, the parami, the perfection of a bodhisattva to be patient, which led into a larger discussion about that sense of must or demand or obligation inside ourselves when we got to say it, we got to do it, we got to make the point, we got to prevail, we got to point out the error in their ways, whatever it is, and violate, therefore, one of the five criteria for wise or right speech from the Buddha, namely timeliness. It's not timely, and it's because of our drive or impatience. That's the quick summary. And I've posted that talk on my website and also wisebrain.org, so if you want to hear it, it was full of some practical stuff as well as a lot of embarrassing details about my personal life. So it had good value. It had good value. I actually asked my wife for her permission. She wanted to listen to it before I posted it. She went, nah, it's okay. I trust you. Anyway, so then you, et cetera, in the back row there in the bleachers said, well, what about situations, and I want to make sure I'm tracking it, and I'll get some other examples, where all that right speech stuff, but it's really time to say something. What do we do then, right? Is that more or less, I got it, all right? Okay, and so I wondered if you'd be willing, and again, only be as divulging as you want, because your voice might be heard on the recording, you know, what are one or two examples of situations where, it really is time to assert yourself in some real way? You know, maybe you're being messed with at work, or there's some kind of clear pattern of discrimination, or you're with someone who just is stonewalling your requests. You've got to take it to a higher level, maybe in a personal relationship. Maybe you've got a wayward, teenager, friend, parent, what have you, neighbor, whatever it is. You know, it really kind of does feel like it's time to put your foot down in some sense, or be strong and clear in some way. Right. So maybe what are one or two or three examples of such a situation?
I have a friend who has a short trigger, and it's usually coming from something that nobody can figure out where it's coming. And he was at my house and his son, and all of a sudden, completely nothing to do with anything, he said something really nasty to me. And I was just like, whoa. And then I just said, I don't know where that's coming from, but it's not okay to talk to me like that. And it just felt really good to stop it, to feel like I don't deserve to get that kind of behavior. I don't know if that's what you're talking about.
Perfect example, including how you handled it, seemingly in a very appropriate way. And we'll come back to that maybe, what you mustered inside to respond in that way. Yeah. That's great. Okay, yeah, great.
So the reason I brought it up is because I'm having a huge situation at work where I'm the last.
Like what?
Like, very difficult.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And that in some ways they're towing the company line, but I think the people that they've chosen are going way above and beyond that because they're afraid for their jobs. And so this atmosphere of fear and has come down to us, to we employees, and there's intimidation and there's a lot of, it's very painful. And I don't know, so the reason I brought it up is because I feel like I want to be the fearless Buddha, but then part of me doesn't want to lose my job, doesn't want to say something out of reactivity, but wants to be, and wants to be compassionate too, and wants to, all the things that encompass being in this practice.
Yeah.
But yet there is something there that I feel like needs to be said, but I don't want to be the one to lose my job over it. So anyway, that's why I brought it up, because it's really personal to me. How do you ever make those decisions? And I feel like the longer you meditate, the more you figure it out. But how does that happen, and what can we do to facilitate that? To make sure that as we meditate, we're building that sense of doing the right thing, not just the thing that maybe will help in the short term, but cause a lot of problems in the long term.
Right. That's great. Thank you. And in part, you're naming, in effect, implicitly, one of the critiques of personal growth or contemplative practice generally, this idea that people will use their capacity to go inside and manage their reactions internally to sort of dampen the appropriate fires of outrage or motivation for social justice work or a willingness to put themselves on the line for some greater good, let alone kind of spin out into some lotus eater internal bliss world, you know, rather than stick it to the man. Right? So yeah, that's an important consideration. How do we balance that? So just naming that out loud. Maybe one more person? I see a hand, great.
Well, just, you know, someone's like using alcohol or some kind of substance. And,
yeah.
You know, you love them and you want to shape them up, but you have to speak the truth to them a lot of times. It's
yeah. Okay. So we kind of get the range, right? So thinking about doing this, and I have a feeling this will go into next week, you know, and I thought of titling this talk, Buddhist Assertiveness is Not an Oxymoron. In other words, there really is a place. If anything, you can actually be more powerful. My personal experience of you know, teachers of my own, of mine is that when they look you in the eye and they say the thing, it has a lot of heft to it. I've told you the story, those of you that have been here before, very briefly, I was very lucky to be in a room with the Dalai Lama and merely 150 or so other people. And at one point he asked people who are a bunch of teachers, had you, you know, this famous Tibetan book, Sommerharma, and you know, you've read it, right? And you just feel everybody going, uh-oh. And he just kind of scanned the room and went, hmm. And that was it. And we were all incredibly chastened. Oh my God. The Dalai Lama went, hmm. You know what I mean? So, you know, you have a certain force to you. So thinking about this, I wanted to kind of quickly check the boxes, you know, the checklist manifesto, the pre-flight checklist, so some basic to-dos that are foundational on the basis of which to kind of get more into it. Okay? And so internally, you might think about a situation where you're grappling with something difficult and you've got to kind of sort out, what am I going to do about it? And you can maybe use these things I'm going to go through really quite quickly because we've talked about them before and there are other resources about them, especially on my website and so forth. And then we'll get into the, you know, where the rubber meets the road. So first off, looking internally, it's really worth asking, are, as it were, the four poisons present or not? Or the four fuels of the fire of suffering? In other words, is there hatred in a broad sense? In other words, am I... is there fear and anger? Have I gone to war with this situation? I can be strong about it. I can be firm about it. There can be anger present. But have I tipped over into going to war with it? Or am I really, really frightened related to it? I think I said last week these three words of the Buddha's that described people, you know, he was saying, be this way, that really stuck in my mind because I can remember three things. Peaceable, friendly, and fearless. Fearless, isn't that an interesting word as a real descriptor of someone mature in their practice? Fearless. So is that fire being fueled or is it basically, are you okay there? Second, in terms of the, I call it the approaching reward system of the brain, the kind of mammalian system of the brain that seeks rewards, is there greed? Is there a drivenness to drive a point home? Is there some kind of pursuit of an inappropriate sense pleasure? Are you, you know, trying to gain a goal and you've just tipped? It's not wholesome aspiration. You just have tipped into a kind of drivenness about it. That's a question. And hopefully not. And you try to help yourself not fuel those fires. Third, is there heartache? Are you reactivated? Are you in the red zone, in other words, with feelings of inadequacy or abandonment or narcissistic injury or envy or loneliness? You know, are you triggered by them? Are you blinking red inside your internal dashboard? And if so, try to be aware of that and try to get out of that place to a more centered place. And then last, is there the poison or fuel for the fire of suffering of delusion? Are you not really seeing things clearly? Do you have only a partial picture? very often in the mosaic of a situation, when we're reactivated, we lock onto one tile and we kind of miss the big picture. Or we get really focused on now, this time, and we lose sight of the 40-year view. You know, for example, raising kids, teenagers, for example, a lot of things happen during those few years that then have 40 years of consequences. I've seen a lot of people, myself included, as a young adult, who were in a lot of ways estranged from their parents because of stuff that went down, you know, even just like one event, one word, one bad night, and kaboom, you know, a different path was then taken. So, yeah, I think a lot about raising kids is to lose the battle to win the war, in a sense. Obviously, there are ultimate lines that you got to decide what they are that you don't want to let be crossed. But, you know, there's a lot of intermediate stuff where if you take the long view, you realize, yeah, I could prevail here, but it would be a Pyrrhic victory. You know, I'd be cutting off my nose, as it were, despite my face. Okay, so checklist, right? You know, is there peace instead of fear and anger, hopefully, right? Is there a basic sense of contentment and enoughness instead of frustration and disappointment? Is there a basic sense of feeling loved and loving instead of envy, inadequacy, shame, and aggression toward them, right? Is there clarity instead of delusion? Right there. You know, if we get it, we take care of it over here, we're going to be a lot more effective when we interact with them over there. Second, have you really handled your own piece of the pie? You know, I have this thing I think of the 80-20 rule where, you know, in an interaction or a relationship, you know, I think there's a place for focusing on what the other person could do better. There's a place for that, whether it's in business or at the hot dog stand or in an intimate relationship. But really quickly, I want to focus on what I could do better and go to the max of personal responsibility for whatever's reasonable in the other person's grievance about me. It's a very quick way to put yourself on the moral high ground, to give them fewer causes for complaint, and to put yourself also in a position where you're a lot stronger in terms of asking for what you need. So are you taking care of your side of the street? Okay, so let's suppose that's true, right? Okay, those are the prelims, right? Now we're getting ready to figure out what to do. First question is, what's your intention? The Buddha was so clear about that again and again and again. What's the intention? To quote Joseph Goldstein, American Buddhist teacher, everything rests on the tip of motivation. That was one of the short list, really, of genuine innovations from the Buddha. Because in the Brahmanic, Vedic culture of his day, 2,500 years ago, it was all about actions. So if you give the priest money to do ritual sacrifices, you know, you'll have a fortunate rebirth. It's just about action. You may not have any particular intention when you give the priest money for the ritual sacrifices, but action is all it took. The Buddha said, no, it's about intention. It's about consciousness. It's about what's happening in your mind. It's not what your hands do. It's what your mind does. That's the fundamental engine of karma, the laws of cause and effect. In other words, so intention is fundamental. So in a situation with people, whether it's at work, and that's a great example, or with someone who's using or abusing drugs, or with someone who speaks to us inappropriately, what's the prize to keep our eyes upon? And I find often that the truth is, we could get this, but we aim for that, or we do get this, and then we ruin this by continuing to battle for that. Because we've lost our sense of what our actual aim is in this particular situation. So it's really powerful to ask oneself, in this moment, back and forth, or in this relationship more generally, or over the next day or week altogether, what's my intention? Otherwise, we tend to get driven by reactivity. That question? Second, related to intention, am I trying to grow roses in a parking lot? Right? What's the line? Don't send a duck to eagle school. Okay? Or as the Buddha put it, and again, he was super emphasis on this, what are the causes and conditions that are present? Are the causes and conditions present to really bring this into being? You know? Do I have the horses here? Do I have, hopefully you'll forgive the metaphor, do I have the firepower to prevail? Do I have the standing? Do I have the basis? Do I have the allies? is there the capacity in the other person to even hear what I'm saying? Or am I trying to grow roses in a parking lot? Am I trying to get blood from some kind of stone? And that goes to, I think, one of the great Dharma teachings, which is in Stephen Covey's book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I think he got it from somewhere else, I don't know where. It's these two simple circles, the circle of concern and the circle of influence. Concern is what we care about. Influence is where we actually have efficacy, where the causes and conditions are available for what we can actually bring into being. Which then goes to intention. If our intention is to have results that are outside our circle of influence, that's hope, not intention. There's a place for hope. I sure wish the government of Haiti would function, period, in a decent way. But that's outside of my power. For me to intend that they do that and get struggle and activated about that, that's just going to cause suffering for me and probably for other people as well. So it's really, I think, worth asking in situations, what actually are the gains that can be gotten here in a good sense? You know, and then can I go after those? And that obviously, what those are depend on the particular situations. Now, in that context, what is in our circle of influence is communicating for ourselves. You just see again and again, you know, I don't know, if you've had a chance to read very many of the discourses that in the Pali Canon, in a good translation, they're very readable. And a lot of them have this high drama, okay? Someone will come to confront the Buddha. He's wandered into some new village, and some young stud is going to challenge the big dog. You know, it has that quality to it, right? And talk him out of it, or show him the error of his ways, or ask him that one question that'll just sort of blow everything up and all. You know, that's how it's done. Okay, fine. That was the culture. And you can see the Buddha, he's not trying to convince the other person. He's responding. You know, and he's tracking the sincerity. And a lot of people came to him were very sincere. They weren't combative. And you can see how he's responding in a different tone to them. But people would come to him in a very combative way. He knew there was an audience. So he was speaking what he saw as the truth. That was what was within his circle of influence. And he left it at that. He didn't go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, where he's trying to, he wasn't like Crossfire or Hardball or whatever these shows are, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It was like he just said it, and, you know, that's what he could do. He was speaking for himself. So I think very often with other people, here are these distinctions. Is the truth named to yourself? Do we claim the freedom to name the truth to ourselves? Because very often that is really compromised in messed up family systems or organizational systems, because the power structure doesn't want people to name the truth out loud. And the first step in preventing that is to get them to not name the truth to themselves. I mean, 1984 by George Orwell is just brilliant at that. So can you name the truth to yourself? Can you name the truth to an ally? That's the next level that's appropriate and safe, right? That's within your power to do, probably. And then the third level is, can you name the truth as you see it to the other person while being at peace with whatever they do? It's okay to want to influence them. We're continually working with influence. It's important to be clear about the ethics of that and so forth. It's cooperation, that's negotiation, that's persuasion. There's a place for that, mutual understanding, and so forth. But is that our driving force versus simply saying what we see is true and leaving it at that? So that part. And then sometimes that's all we do in situations. Minimally, we name it to ourselves. And we look around and we go, I don't have the horses to win here. I don't have the cards in my hand. I'm not going to win here. There's just going to be a lot of collateral damage. But I'm going to be at peace with the situation, protect myself, and just kind of live my life in this way. Sometimes that's what we do, and that's our way of dealing with a sucky situation. Other times what we do is we play the long game to win. We recognize that I don't have the horses, but I can accumulate them. I can gradually build up a paper trail in corporate environments. I can gradually build up allies in appropriate ways. I can arrange for lessons to come into the lives of other people without my fingerprints on the blade, as it were. Okay, with good intention. Again, what's the intention? I think a lot with raising kids, that's and young adults especially, that's a lot of what we do. You know, we really look forward to them having their job because their boss is going to be hassling them about coming in late, la-di-da, yet again, and it won't be mom or dad doing it this time, you know? So we arrange for things off stage. And then, ultimately, do we want to feel like we can actually try to make something happen? And then I'll finish on this and then see what you think about all this. I think it's a very interesting moment, actually, to become genuinely assertive. And I want to kind of go through a few things about it. The first is, are we actually in the body? Because I think often, you know, when we're assertive, we have fear about it, there's a tendency to dissociate, or we're just really caught up in our case and the words we want to use, whatever they are. And we just kind of lose touch with the body. And there's this classic line, you know, from the Buddha, in this fathom-long body are to be found all the causes of suffering and liberation. So staying in touch with the body. You know, if you ever go to Spirit Rock, there's this gratitude hut they have there. It's the coolest place there. One of my major favorite places there. And they have all these teachings from various people. And in the major lineage of the teachers that led to the Spirit Rock teachers, and I'm kind of in that lineage, or stream, is Ajahn Mun, M-U-N. And if you ever look at his photograph, you just go, because he's got these eyes that are totally penetrating and clear and relentless and peaceful and scary all at once. And then he has this little quote. And the quote they put up, he says, in all your investigations, never lose awareness of the body. You know, in some deep sense. So are we in the body, right? And then being in the body, do we have a quality of self-respect and, in a word, gravity? I think a lot of people err on either side. They either don't say what they could say or they sputter. Rather than being in that middle place of gravity and directness and groundedness and a sense of personal authority. And you might want to look inside yourself about your own access to that felt sense. When you've had it, can you pull up the body memory of that sense of seriousness and gravity? It's interesting. It's not aggressive, but it's not to be fooled with. You know what I mean? And I think about, I don't know if you ever saw this film, Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip when he was alive. This was his first show. He's an African-American comedian, no longer alive, after he was using crack. And the crack pipe blew up in his face. So he was burned, nearly killed, recovered. It's a funny show. And there's this little pantomime he does in the show where he's interacting with his friend, the famous football player, big guy. Jim Brown, there we go. Just male authority incarnate, you know? And so I'll do this quickly, then I'll shut up. Here we go. So Richard Pryor's, and I'm not a very good actor, but anyway, he says, oh, well, Jim, yeah, you want some, you know, and like, oh, I'm feeling really great. Try some, Jim. You know, this is really wonderful. Don't worry about it. And then he does Jim Brown's voice. Richard, what you gonna do? Whoa, why are you giving me that attitude, Jim? I mean, I'm really fine. Everything's cool. It's just drugs, you know? Like, what's the problem? I'm an adult. Richard, what you gonna do? Well, I'm really scared, you know, blah, 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 blah. Richard, what you gonna do? And he just stayed there. That was the Jim Brown mode, you know? And we've been with people who are just very clear, they're very centered, where we are just zeroed in on what's actually true and what we actually need. That's where the structure of nonviolent communication is really helpful. These are the facts as I see them. I'm not trying to persuade you about them. These are the facts as I see them. Given these facts, I experience such and such. I feel sad. I feel let down. I feel scared. I feel squelched. I feel mistreated. Because, like everybody, I need this. I need to feel safe. I need to feel a frame of reliability. I need to know that my friend, Richard Pryor, is not going to kill himself yet again with crack cocaine, right? I have these needs. You know, so that's a good format. When X happens, I feel Y because I need Z. But fundamentally, we're grounded in gravity and communicating from that place. Okay, so I just wanted to go through that. Quick summary. For me, some headlines that have really worked for me, including last, not recognizing we can't control the outcome. That's where the equanimity and compassion teachings come together, where we never lose our sense of the suffering of the other person and ourselves. And we may put them out of our company or our bed, but we never put them out of our heart. And as the Buddha said, even if bandits are severing your limbs with saws, you never lose touch with your loving kindness for them. So we stay grounded, you know, in that, while at the same time being really clear, all we can do is what's in our own circle of influence, you know, and then we be at peace with whatever results. What do you think? Or situations?
When I asked him, you know, what are those thuds? He says, I don't hear anything. I think maybe it's the other neighbor. So I thought, okay, maybe some other neighbor got those, and I can hear them from their place, which is kind of ridiculous, but I thought I would check it out because I trusted him at that point. And so the thuds kept happening and waking me up. He gets up real early, I get up later. And it's like it's been a very difficult situation about not wanting to be awakened and also have seen somebody lie to me.
He's a tenant?
Pardon me?
Is he a tenant?
Downstairs.
Yeah, on your property? Oh, okay, I got it. Yeah. Yeah. So you're wondering what to do, or you have taken action?
I've gone through, you know, all kinds of stuff of my own.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, anger.
Lots. Yeah.
Just that he's lying to me, and not only waking me up in the morning, but he's lying to me.
Yeah.
Saying that I don't even call it barbells anymore. I don't want to confront him with his own lie because I'll just get a reaction. So I say the thuds, if they could only happen like after like 9:30, it would be okay. But they continue.
Yeah. And is that where things stand now?
More or less.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting situation, right? Because, you know, and just I'll be brief about it. I think sometimes our smart move is to get allies.
Get what?
Allies.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that.
If we can. So, no, it's not always. And there are risks even in speaking up to allies. But right there is another thing. For example, whether it's in a family situation or a company situation or just in life, do we have allies who are with us? And where are we at about, you know, like the joke about men and women driving, men are not willing to ask for directions, right? Are we willing to ask for assistance, for allies, even just to bear witness to our circumstance, or be a landlord or management company, or the ally of the lease agreement that says, or the rental agreement altogether that says that, you know, inappropriate noise before certain hours is a problem, right? Or is there anything we can do? So that's one thing, is to build up resources for ourselves. I could think of multiple situations where I kind of rushed in to asserting myself or speaking up, and then I realized, uh-oh, you know what I mean? You like look back and you're like 100 feet ahead of your friends, and uh-oh, and the dragon's breathing fire at your face, and oh. So, you know, building up allies, and that's very important. And then I also think that there's something that's been lost a lot in our culture these days, or it's weakened. It's actually interesting to think about it. We've had this rise. I was actually listening to a rock and roll song from the 80s when I was running yesterday, Oingo Boingo. I'm confessing some cool aspects of my life, but anyway, maybe not so cool. But it's a song, Insanity, which is very much about the rise of the moral majority in the early 1980s. We're talking now 30 years ago. All right. So there's been this rise in the culture on the one hand of a kind of moral righteousness. But on the other hand, there's been, I think, a weakening of people's willingness to look each other in the eye and communicate about a moral issue with a sense of entitlement, healthy entitlement, not shaming, not weird stuff. But, you know, kid, I saw you put your hand in the cookie jar. I see parents routinely who are uncomfortable exercising moral authority with their own children or being a moral authority, and being morally self-confident about that. Similarly, are we willing to look someone in the eye and say, you know, young man, I know you lied to me. I can't stop you from lying to me, but I want you to know that I know that you know that I know that you lied to me. Now you decide if you want to do that. Okay, I'm going to do another person. All right, yeah, because we're going to wrap up close to on time. Yep?
I love what you're saying.
Pardon me, let me interrupt you, sorry. Because you know what? I'm not saying you should do that, but that is in your power to do. That's in your power to do. I'm bearing witness to what happened and leave it at that, you know, and then turn around and walk away or something. Like, whoa! How often does someone actually look us in the eye and call us on our stuff?
Maybe you wouldn't look me in the eye.
Maybe not, but what's in your power to do? I mean, for me a lot, and I definitely will come, I want to feel in my heart, and again, decide for yourself, I want to know that I said it, because I grew up in a very inhibited home. And I think also if you belong to a group of people who have been inhibited by culture and politics, et cetera, classically, like women, for example, I'd be particularly careful about feeling at all muzzled. You can make an error the other way too, obviously, but like, minimally, I want to say it. And I've repeatedly had experiences with people that I'll say it. And I'll speak for myself. I'll say it. And they'll act like it never happened. Or they'll sputter and flame and spew. Or they'll deny it completely. Right? But then they change as a result. Fine. Okay.
Well, I love what you were saying. But in terms of in the workplace, we do work in business using social and cognitive behavioral psychology to teach people how to take ethically courageous action when it's hard. And what's interesting is definitely allies, because we often say, oh, I should go say this, and you go it alone, and you don't have the impact on the system that you want, because one person rarely does. But the other thing we forget is practicing, because if you feel that way, it's unlikely you're the only one. So if you do have people that you trust enough to talk to, practicing the situation, we call them social flight simulations, you start to create the muscle memory. You also learn what you want to say, because there is a risk, as you say. I mean, it's not just go do the right thing. You don't want to lose your job. And if you practice it, sometimes you can get a feel for what can I do? And you get to play it out. I mean, that's the nice thing about cognitive behavioral. If the worst happens, is it worth it to me to do this? And what can I do? And then, as you're saying, you're not focused on the outcome, but can you do what you promise yourself that you'll do?
Yeah, I want to add, maybe if I could, just, I think, 2.5 comments, you know, rather brief, to build on what you said, and that's great, and I'm interested in what you're talking about there. How often also do we, in a heartfelt way, reveal the impact of the other person on us? Often we don't. And there's this nice distinction from diversity work between intent and impact. You know, for example, on our side as the, if you will, transmitter, our intent may be neutral or even benign, but unwittingly our impact is negative. And we can understand why, and we can see that without walking on eggshells, we can shift things a bit that will have a different impact. Flip the other way, sometimes other people don't actually realize their impact. You know, Gurdjieff said most people are sleepwalking. I think a lot of people are pretty unconscious, actually, of their impact. They actually, for example, don't realize that things are audible, or they don't realize that they actually use that tone of voice. They don't get it. And speaking from the heart about, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh has this lovely way of talking with someone that we have a grievance with, where we really communicate. You have to be appropriate about it, obviously, especially in a business setting, where we communicate impact, how we feel hurt or sad or scared or lost or just upset or frustrated or what have you. There's a place for that. I think it has a lot of power. That's one. A second thing is, for me, to see if it's worth it to you, I think about the notion of karma, you know, someone else's definition, as hitting golf balls in a tiled shower, right? And then, to some extent, and I started to think about the ways in which sometimes we are the appropriate karma, we are the justice coming toward that other person. That uncomfortable moment where they have to be with us, where they're hearing us, where they're feeling our energy, where we're naming what's true, we're bringing it out of the shadows, out of the family secret category, out into the open. In effect, we are the implementation of justice on them. Obviously, there are pitfalls with that. We have to be careful about getting grandiose and highfalutin and, you know, using this as a clever way to justify our own bad attitude about other people. But when I realized that actually me communicating in a clean, appropriate way was their opportunity to learn. And they might need 500 opportunities to learn for the 500th one to actually work, but I'm number 187, you know? But you gotta have 187 to have 188, you know, and finally work your way to 500. So that might be a way to think about yourself. And you realize that, you know, within limits, we're just not responsible for the experience of other people. And then the last thing to say is, it's right in front of our noses all the time, but in a funny way, like a lot of things right in front of our nose is hard to see. And this goes in many ways to the deepest teaching of the Buddha, which basically is that if you look at experience, just experience, and you look at experience as experience, not experience as representing something material. In other words, I could look at this, you could look at this, and go, oh, the sight, there's a thing there. Right? This is what Mother Nature wants us to do all day long, to infer from sounds that there are children's or people's voices out there, to infer from, you know, sensations on the body that there's a physical object pushing on us. That's what she wants us to do. There's a place for that. That's healthy. In my metaphysics, I really think there's stuff out there. Okay? That's great. The Buddha basically acknowledged that there's stuff out there. But then he said, hey, bring it in here and look at experience as experience. Look closely at what is the actual nature of sounds or sights, tastes, touches, smells, thoughts, feelings, hopes and dreams, etc. And if you look closely at them, you realize that the actual experience of a sight or a sound or a feeling, a form, as it were, moving through the mind, is insubstantial. You can't hold on to it, and it can't give you any lasting satisfaction. And if we have that kind of radical recognition of the nature of our own experiencing, including of difficult people, you know, it moves us to a kind of balance, a kind of disenchantment, where we're not so rattled by the unpleasant sights and sounds, and we're not so hypnotized by our fantasies of how good it will be if it just gets better with this person. We have more equanimity about it. And we have equanimity because we realize that our actual experiencing moment to moment to moment is not a reliable basis for lasting happiness. And that's his radical teaching, you know, and it's available to us even in situations where someone's rubbing us the wrong way. How about we sit for a minute and practice with this and come back next week? you. If you can, I'll say two more things very quickly. One is to be in our experience as we name our experience. That gives it much authority. In other words, feel it as we say it. Are we in the body as we say it? That's another key. And then last, sometimes we have to redefine the game to one we can win at. In other words, we don't have the horses to change the circumstances, but we redefine the game. Like, what is success for me? So that the outcomes I care about, in other words, we're moving the circle of concern over to the circle of influence. I have this much influence, really. I'm going to redefine my goals so that the influence I do have is capable innately of actually achieving them, right? I may not be able to grow roses in my parking lot because I'm in a parking lot, but I can grow crabgrass. What's wrong with crabgrass? And cockroaches, no less. Okay, see you next week. Thank you.